Good day. Today is Sunday, 1st March 2026. And before I proceed with this program, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched and listened to this program, you decide that you like what you have heard and seen and wish to indicate that fact. Now, in my program yesterday, at the start of my program yesterday, I said, based on information that was coming from the Iranian Foreign Ministry, that it looked as if this time, in the attack that took place against Iran yesterday, the Iranians had succeeded in avoiding the mass death of senior Iranian leaders that took place at the start of the 12-day war in June 2025. Well, that view held for most of the day yesterday, and it held, as I recall, for the period, for a certain period after my program was published, my program obviously having been made some time before. But then information, initially from Israel, and then from President Trump himself, and then eventually from Iran too, showed that that was completely wrong. In fact, large numbers of key Iranian decision makers were killed in the Israeli and American strikes yesterday. So briefly, the defense minister, the chief of the general staff, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, one of Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader's top security advisors, the head of the intelligence service of the Iranian police, and as we subsequently learned, the supreme leader himself, Ayatollah Khamenei, were all killed. Now, I have to say, yet again, I find this very strange and very difficult to understand. I was checking my programs over the last couple of days. The program that I made 2 days before specifically spoke about the fact that an attack was imminent, an attack on Iran was imminent. Its title, in fact, was US-Iran Talks Fail, Embassies Evacuated, Attack Imminent. And the caption on the title was Attack is Coming. Now, that video was published on the 27th of February at 18:10 hours London time. And like all of my videos, it was made, of course, some time before. We have to process and edit videos before we publish them. So it was absolutely clear to me, many hours before the combined Israeli and American attack took place, that an attack was coming. The closures of embassies and the evacuation of embassy staff from various Middle East countries made that absolutely clear, as was the rhetoric in President Trump's State of the Union address, and as were the reports following the failure of the talks mediated by Iran between the United States, mediated by Oman between the United States and Iran in Geneva. There should have been no doubt in Tehran that an attack was either about to happen or that it was an overwhelmingly likely possibility. And yet, all of these people were killed in the first hours of the Israeli-American attack, just as happened during the attack in June, and the supreme leader himself, Ayatollah Khamenei, was killed. And moreover, we are told by the Iranian media, I've been checking them this morning, that at the time when the attack took place, he was in his residence. Claims, by the way, that he was in a bunker don't seem to be true. He was in his residence. Members of his family were there. No obvious precautions had been made to ensure his safety. Now, to me, as I said, this is all extraordinary and very, very difficult to understand. I would have thought that, especially after the events of June last year, that the Iranian authorities would take some steps to both protect their leader himself, to put him in a safe place, and also to ensure that other key officials in the Iranian military and security system were in safe places and were properly protected as well. Now, there is some information which makes it all even more extraordinary, because the Israelis are saying that all of these people were killed by Israel. It was the Israelis who attacked Khamenei's compound, that the Israelis killed all of these people within a space of 40 seconds, which would be consistent with them all having been gathered together in the same place, which appears to have been Khamenei's residence. Now, I say that, of course, I don't know that for a fact, but it's consistent with what the Israelis appear to be saying. And it is also consistent with some reports that I've seen that at the time when Khamenei was killed, he was in a meeting with around 40 senior Iranian officials who would, in that case, if all of these people who were killed yesterday were indeed in the same place, have included the defense minister, the chief of staff, one of his own top security advisors, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and who knows whom else. Now, I have seen reports circulating that Khamenei had, before this attack, already made a decision that he was going to die over the course of whatever attack Israel and the United States launched against Iran. I believe that this is true. A couple of days ago, about a week ago, I read an article in the British media. I believe it was in the Financial Times, but I'm not sure, which said exactly the same thing, that Khamenei had made a decision, had accepted that he would not survive any further attack by the United States and Israel against Iran, that he was fortunate to have survived the 12-day war, that his priority was to ensure not his own life, to guarantee not his own life, but the preservation of the political system, the Islamic Republic in Iran. And as a Shia Muslim, a senior cleric, a member of a religion that embraces martyrdom, he was prepared to accept martyrdom in order to facilitate his cause. Now, I should say that over the last few hours, I've tried to locate this article, but I have not been able to do so. I'm afraid I read so many articles that it is impossible for me to preserve all of them. And this particular article I cannot find. However, I have referred to it in several recent programs. So I can completely understand, based on Khamenei's known beliefs and on the information that Iranian sources were providing the British media, that Khamenei himself accepted martyrdom, placed himself in a position of not just vulnerability, but in a position where he certainly knew that he would be killed, And he did that in the belief that this would ensure the ultimate success of his cause. However, if that is true, which it might very well be, then how does one explain the presence of members of his family at the same residence? Why did he not take the precaution of sending them away? Did they perhaps choose to die with him? It is not impossible. But if the claims, or at least the rumours, that all of these people who were killed were in the same place, were in Hamene's residence, then what were they all doing there? One can understand why Khamene himself might have chosen to make himself vulnerable in that sort of way, might have embraced martyrdom. But then why call all of these other people together to one place, if that is indeed what happened, making them an obvious target for elimination in the way that took place? Well, I don't know exactly what happened, and I think this is the first thing to say, and I don't know what the motivations and the reasons of all of these people were. But this, again, is part of that pattern of very strange, to me, barely explicable decisions of the Iranian authorities, which they have consistently made ever since the start of this crisis in the spring of 2024, which I do not understand. Their inability to take precautions to safeguard themselves, despite the fact that they were clearly being hunted for elimination by Israel and by the United States. Their perennial problems in ensuring security, and the exposure to extreme vulnerability of their top officials. Now, these are things that I do not understand, but by contrast, Iran's decision to withhold this information for several hours makes total sense to me. The Iranians, who were clearly not surprised by the fact that so many of their top people, including their supreme leader, were killed, would have wanted to strike back hard, or at least to strike back visibly, against the United States especially, and to some extent Israel, in the minutes and hours after the attack itself, to demonstrate both to their own people and to the world, and of course to the United States and Israel, that whatever the Americans and the Israelis thought that they had achieved by the attack, Iran's political system was intact, it was stable, that there were still key people able to make the necessary decisions, and that the objective of regime change had not been achieved. And only once that message had been conveyed, first and foremost, of course, to Iran's own people, did it become appropriate to start releasing and confirming information that Khamenei and all of these other top officials, senior people in Iran, had all been killed. And by that time, of course, the Iranians had also had time to rebuild their command structures. There's been reports that all of these people, at least most of these people, who were killed on the first day have been replaced, and that there is an acting supreme leader. He is said to be Alireza Arafsi, an Ayatollah whom I must admit I have never heard of before, but then what do I know about Iranian Ayatollahs. I might not even have got his name exactly correct. But anyway, he is now the interim supreme leader until, presumably after the 40 days of mourning are over, a new supreme leader from within the clerical leadership is chosen. Meanwhile, it has become clear that the single most important decision maker, the person who has in fact been running the country, apparently since the protests in January, Khamenei's national security advisor, Ali Larijani, is essentially in control of Iran. It is he who is running the intelligence and security forces and the defense forces, and it is he who is organizing and running the resistance against the United States and Israel. Now, in my program yesterday, I said that this was a test of endurance, whether Iran and its political system would be able to absorb the blow that had been inflicted on them by Israel and the United States. I said, and I still say, that Israel and the United States do not have the ability to sustain operations on this scale for more than, well, let's be optimistic and say a few weeks. And that if Iran comes through this at the other end with its leadership and its political system still functioning and intact, then in effect it will have won. Victory for Iran in this conflict is achieved through survival. It is not achieved through military action against the United States and Israel, though some of that is of course happening. The United States and Israel, by contrast, have made it absolutely clear what their objective is. I've discussed this extensively in my recent programs, in particular my program yesterday. The objective is clearly now regime change in Iran. There can be no possible doubt about that. If regime change is not achieved, then the mission will have failed. And given all of the resources that the United States and Israel have thrown into this operation, the successful elimination of the supreme leader himself, then it becomes difficult to see how success, if it is not achieved within a couple of weeks, or let's say a month's time, if it is not achieved then, how it is going to be achieved at all, short of an outright invasion of Iran and perhaps resort to extreme weapons, ideas that I do not wish to contemplate. Now, none of that calculus has been changed in any way by the events of the last 24 hours, notwithstanding the killing of Khamenei himself and all of those other top officials. I would, in fact, suggest that the early indications are that the elimination of Khamenei might have actually had the opposite effect to the one intended. I said that there were some reasons to think, and some claims have been made, and there were earlier reports in the media, the British media, explaining Khamenei's intentions, which were consistent with this, that Khamenei's objective was to achieve martyrdom in order to safeguard and strengthen his cause. Well, as of last night, large numbers of people did turn out onto the streets in Iran, but they were not opponents of the government. Overwhelmingly, they were supporters, and they seemed to fill the streets, and there was no sign of protests or of splits on the part of the military, or of defections from the military, or of military units moving into Tehran in order to seize control, or anything like that. It could be that the death of Khamenei has solidified the political system and reconnected it to the wider population, the vast majority of whom, it must never be forgotten, are themselves Shia Muslims. And it's important to remember that this event, this killing of Khamenei, has taken place as all Muslims around the world celebrate Ramadan, a fact which will have added further poignancy to his death. In which case, a fall of the government, regime change in Iran, might have been made more difficult by the events of yesterday than perhaps might have been the case if Khamenei had indeed survived. Now, I said that regime change requires defections on the part of the Iranian military. Seymour Hersh, of course, recently wrote an article on his blog in which he said that the Israelis and the Americans were in contact with sections of the military. I don't know whether that is true. I saw that John Bolton, Donald Trump's arch neocon national security advisor, who has been an ardent advocate of regime change in Iran, yesterday said the same thing. He said that for regime change in Iran to happen, there need to be splits in the military, some members of the military, some military units in Iran need to break, to defect, and to go over to the side, in effect, of the Americans and the Israelis, and presumably the former Iranian crown prince or whatever other parts of the opposition in Iran there still are. And without that happening, the whole project of regime change in Iran, which is, to repeat again, what this whole operation is ultimately all about, will be unsuccessful. Well, so far, as I said, as of last night, none of that seemed to have happened. On the contrary, it could be, it might be, that with the Supreme Leader martyred in the way that he has been, the political system has stabilised and has consolidated. And as I said, it continues for the time being to take its instructions from the man who has clearly been running Iran for about a month now, who is Khamenei's former national security advisor, Larijani, who survived yesterday's attacks and who has in fact been making various public comments. I believe he did so in a broadcast to the Iranian people, informing them that the fight continues and that Iran will ultimately prevail. So anyway, that is the situation. Now, there are a number of further things to say before I leave this topic of Khamenei's death and the death of all of these other officials. But let's focus first on Khamenei. And it is a point that I've made many times, which is that Khamenei was the person who made the fatwa, essentially prohibiting Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, even as it was Khamenei who agreed that Iran should enrich uranium up to the 60% level. I have never understood that decision. I've never understood the logic of that as a negotiating strategy. enriching uranium to the level of 60% did not strengthen Iran's position in the nuclear negotiations with the United States. What it did instead, and what it was perfectly predictable that it would do, was reinforce claims that Iran was indeed seeking a nuclear weapon, giving more traction to those people in the United States especially who were insisting on an attack on Iran. It seems to me to have been a complete misjudgment which lost Iran support instead of gaining it leverage. Iran also, over the last few years, has shown an astonishing slowness in accepting help from those who've offered it, from the Russians, from the Chinese. It took a very long time to join BRICS. It has been very, very slow to make use of BRICS since it joined. It took no step, in fact, it still hasn't taken any step, to seek Chinese assistance to stabilize its currency, something that could perfectly easily have been done in December when the United States, as the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has said, orchestrated the collapse of Iran's currency. The Chinese had already apparently offered the Iranian Central Bank a credit swap. The moment it became known that China was offering that sort of assistance and was helping the Iranian Central Bank to stabilize the rial, I have absolutely no doubt at all that the rial would have stabilized. But nothing like that was done or even thought about. And Putin has said, and no one in Iran has contradicted him, that the Russians offered Iran not just individual surface-to-air missiles, but assistance in creating an entire integrated air defense system. And Iran actually rejected the offer when it was made. And that was said by none other than Putin himself. Now, I don't know who made all of these decisions within Iran itself, but all of them must have been discussed with Khamenei himself at some point. And let's say that he never at any time did the obvious thing and said to himself, well, whatever issues we've had with the Russians in the past, and they have been many, we cannot afford at this time, when we are in a critical confrontation with the Israelis and the Americans, who are, by every metric, far more powerful than us, we are simply not in a position to reject this kind of help when it is being offered. And Khamenei did none of these things. So I have to say this, I do wonder whether one possible effect of Khamenei's removal from the scene is that it has removed the key person in Iran who has up to now stood in the way of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons. And the supreme leader, who, increasingly old perhaps, and rigid in his thinking, and perhaps becoming increasingly out of touch, was unable to understand the need to accept economic and financial and military help from Iran at the moment when it was needed. Everyone who discusses Khamenei acknowledges that he was an erudite, clever man. There are references in the Western media to the adjective that's used about him in the Western media is that he was wily. But he was also 86, and I do wonder whether a man of that age and with his kind of scholarly background was really the right person to make the key decisions leading Iran at this time. In fact, I've made this point in previous programs. It could be that removing him from the scene will make it possible, or rather will facilitate, a situation where a younger, more adaptable, more flexible supreme leader starts to make entirely different decisions to integrate Iran more closely in the BRICS, to seek military cooperation with Iran's friends, first and foremost with the Russians, to build on other potential alliances, and perhaps most controversially of all, to make a decision once and for all about Iran's nuclear program. Does it intend to stick with it? And if it does stick with it, it does decide to stick with it, is it finally going to push it to what some would say is its logical conclusion? I had discussed in many programs in the past, including a whole cluster of programs that I made at the end of 2024, that several top Iranian officials had made fairly clear in late autumn 2024, early spring 2025, that they were frustrated by Khamenei's decision to block development of nuclear weapons in Iran, that they considered that the way for Iran to guarantee itself to achieve long-term security from Israeli and American attack was for Iran to become a nuclear weapons power. To be absolutely clear, this is not something I want to see at all. I am a strong supporter of nuclear non-proliferation, but it has seemed to me entirely understandable, in fact completely logical, why senior Iranian officials might be thinking otherwise. And I mentioned in recent programs that I believe it was in April 2025, the US intelligence community published a further report saying that there was no sign that Iran was in fact moving forward with developing a nuclear weapon. But in that same report, published by the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, the US intelligence community mentioned the very same thing that I'd picked up, which is that more and more Iranian officials were coming out and were saying that maybe the time had come to reconsider Khamenei's fatwa, to rethink the overall strategy, and to decide whether acquiring a nuclear weapons capability might ultimately be the right thing for Iran to do. Well, to repeat again, that is not what I would want to see, but it would make a kind of sense to me. Well, it may be that with Khamenei gone, whoever finally takes over from him will indeed be the person who takes the plunge and makes that decision. In which case, of course, the general security situation in the Middle East will have taken a decisive, and by the way, in my view, disastrous turn. I absolutely do not want to see nuclear proliferation in that region or in any other region. But anyway, when that happens, it will be clear, or if that happens, it should be clear that the elimination of Khamenei will have had quite a lot to do with it. Anyway, there we are. That's where we are at the present time. Now, before I proceed and discuss the international reaction to the current events, perhaps it's worth talking about the military exchanges, which continue, by the way. Now, yesterday, as we know, the Iranians hit back almost immediately after the Israeli-American attacks. It's clear that their primary target across the Middle East were US military bases. And they do seem to have succeeded in doing significant damage to those bases. I say that there were no American casualties, so we've been told, and so I believe. I presume that the United States evacuated its personnel from those bases before the attacks took place. But there's no doubt, I've seen footage of it, that the American naval base in Bahrain was struck. There's no doubt also that bases in Jordan, in Iraq, in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia, in all of those places, in Qatar, in the UAE, were attacked as well. And the fact that these attacks were taking place also caused considerable shock and dismay in all of these countries. There were pictures of roads jammed with cars as people tried to evacuate. And there are also multiple reports of dismay and hand-wringing on the part of the officials of these governments, even as airlines are now avoiding the Gulf. There were also reports yesterday that the Iranians had taken the first steps to close the Gulf of Hormuz. There were announcements to that effect from Iran, but these announcements, so far as I could see, were being made more by Iranian news agencies than as a result of official statements by Iranian officials. There were very conflicting reports about what was happening over the course of the day, whether the Gulf of Hormuz was indeed closed or not, whether tankers were still sailing through the Gulf of Hormuz. This morning, however, a tanker was indeed attacked, presumably by the Iranians, close to the Straits of Hormuz. And it seems that there is now a build-up of shipping close to the Straits of Hormuz with oil tankers unwilling to take the risk of transit, and reports that insurers are advising the ship owners of these tankers that they will not be covered if they take the risk and send those tankers through the Straits of Hormuz. So maybe there has not yet been an official closure by Iran of the Straits of Hormuz, but something very like that does appear to be happening, and apparently it is causing increasing dismay on the part of Gulf Arab governments. Now, that brings me to the apparently very duplicitous, unsurprisingly duplicitous behaviour of one particular Arab leader, if the reports are true. The Washington Post reports that MBS, the Prime Minister and Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, even as Saudi Arabia was publicly calling for calm and publicly saying that diplomacy should take its course and was opposing military action by the United States and Israel against Iran, that MBS in private was egging President Trump to press forward and to attack Iran. Now, this could be misinformation. It does happen, or it could be a mistake. It depends very much where this information is coming from. But I have to say that so far as I'm aware, there's been no denial about this from Saudi Arabia. And if it did take place, it would not surprise me. MBS is, to put it mildly, a volatile individual. I can quite easily imagine him privately advising the Americans to do one thing, even as publicly he is saying they should do another. It is, unfortunately, the politics of the Middle East. It is how politics in the Middle East happen, and no one should be surprised by it. The Iranians, of course, will treat it as a betrayal, and it might conceivably lead to Iranian attacks on oil installations in Saudi Arabia, though the scale of these installations makes it very, very difficult, it seems to me, to do substantive damage that would not be possible to be repaired within a few weeks or months. Having said that, it's also important to say that Saudi Arabia is apparently financially overstretched, that Saudi Arabia has struggled with the recent fall in oil prices. It's going to be tough for the Saudis to ride this out financially over an extended period, even though their own security apparatus is extremely powerful. Anyway, I'm guessing that the Iranians, like many other people, will want to see this all end as quickly as possible. So far, from what I can tell, though there have been some Iranian strikes on Iran, on Israel, and though these have done a certain amount of damage, I've seen some film footage of damaged or actually destroyed buildings in Tel Aviv. Yesterday, Israel was not the primary Iranian target. Now, both sides, however, launched missiles at each other in enormous numbers. The Iranians claimed that they launched 1,200 missiles over the course of yesterday, attacking American bases. I was skeptical about that report initially, but then the various Gulf states started reporting that they had each of them downed Iranian missiles in their hundreds and Iranian drones in their hundreds as well, just saying, which might make this Iranian claim true. I believe that Israel and the United States also launched, well, who's to say exactly? Anyway, hundreds of missiles at Iran. We know that American missile arsenals are depleted. We know that Israeli missile arsenals are depleted. There's another article, from memory, I think it was in Bloomberg, repeating that very same information this morning. I do wonder for how long the Americans and the Israelis can continue this. And as for the Iranians, I really don't know how great their resilience is. Though I read a report again in the American media yesterday that said that the Americans assess that these Iranians are able to produce missiles at a rate of 100 a month, long-range missiles at a rate of 100 a month, in which case it looks as if the Iranians can maintain a high degree of resiliency altogether. The Iranian strategy seems to me essentially the same as the strategy that worked for Iran during the June 2025 war: to deplete American and Israeli air defences, to put the American military, the American and Israeli militaries in the Gulf under great strain, to then conduct increasingly effective missile strikes on Israel itself and perhaps on the American bases, to put economic pressure through the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, which is what the Iranians came very close to doing in June last year, and to let things play out that way, to treat this as an attrition war, a test of endurance, one which the Americans and the Israelis cannot sustain. Now, Iran's ability to do that depends obviously on the size of its missile stockpile and its ability to continue producing missiles even as these attacks continue. And of course, it depends on its internal stability. And probably it is the second that is more important, which is why I placed so much emphasis on the fact that last night there were no visible cracks in the government and in the political system and in the loyalty of the security forces at all. Now, as for the President of the United States, Donald Trump, you could argue that he now has an off-ramp. He can claim that with the killing of Khamenei, whom he described in a Truth Social post as one of the most evil people in the world. Well, that is a point of view, one which, for the record, I don't agree with. Whatever views one may have of Khamenei, there are all sorts of people around in the world who seem to me to have been far more evil, who seem to me to be far more evil, and who have done far more harm than he ever did. That's, anyway, my view. But anyway, you could argue that with the killing of Khamenei, Trump has now the off-ramp that he can take. He can call this whole thing off. What, however, does he do if, as they say, the Iranians continue to strike at Iran, at American bases and at Israel itself? There was a very angry, at least it seemed to me very angry, tweet and post from Trump this morning, saying that if the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran, actually acts on its threat, the threat that they were making this morning, that they would conduct another even bigger strike against Israel and against American bases over the course of today. Well, if they did that, Trump seemed to imply that the retaliation from the United States would be even more devastating, far more devastating than what we have seen up to now. I have to say that to me, the message looked frightened, came across as that of a man who senses that this situation is not fully under his control. When people are frightened, they tend to become angry, and that was how I read this message. I saw a report somewhere yesterday, to which I'm going to say I don't give particular weight, that even as of yesterday, Trump was angry, that he expected that Khamenei's death would lead to bigger effects in Iran than he expected. But, as I said, I'm not going to place a huge amount of weight on that. For Trump, the absolute nightmare scenario is that American capabilities start to decline, that the US runs out of air defense missiles, and lots of air defense missiles had to be used. shooting down Iranian missiles yesterday. And by the way, they seem to have been only very partially successful in achieving that, at least where the attacks on the US bases were concerned. And he could find himself in a situation where American capabilities are starting to run down, where the Iranians keep conducting strikes, where the Straits of Hormuz remains closed and possibly disrupted. And then, of course, it'd be very difficult to know exactly what he does in a situation like that, which he will have lost control of. But we are not in that situation at the moment. Whether we will get there, as I said, depends on the resilience and endurance over the next few weeks of Iran, on the stability of its political system and the loyalty of its armed forces, most of all. Now, I'm going to finish this section by just discussing two particular points. There is a narrative that is floating around the media that the United States and Israel decided to launch the attack when they did, in less than optimal conditions, because they detected the fact that Khamenei was still in his residence and perhaps was meeting with all of these people at his residence. Now, I find that very difficult to believe. And the reason I say that is because, as I discussed earlier, it was absolutely obvious to me that the United States and Israel were cranking up to conduct a strike, an attack on Iran, hours before this meeting took place, in ways that, given what they were doing, even if they knew that this meeting was going to take place and that Khamenei would have been in his residence, they must have expected would cause all of these people and Khamenei himself to scatter. I refer to the closures of the embassies, to all of the many indications that a strike was coming, going all the way back to President Trump's words at the State of the Union address. The Americans have put up all sorts of reasons and explanations for their decision to strike now, that there was going to be a preemptive strike by Iran. I consider that claim preposterous. That there was going to be other action taken by Iran. I can't imagine what that was. And it seems to me most likely that this claim that this was an attack of opportunity falls into that category. To me, it looks like this was an attack that had been prepared in advance. Maybe there were some adjustments as to the timing. Maybe some people weren't happy that it happened on a moonlit night, and we don't know what, if any, effect that had. But anyway, one way or the other, there were concerns. The decision was clearly made to attack when it was made, and I don't believe that Khamenei's movements had very much to do with it. At least that is my view. Now, the second thing I wanted to say is that there has been a very, very sharp response about all of this, concerning all of this, specifically from the Russians. They appear to be absolutely furious, both with the Americans and with the Israelis. Putin has written to Pezeshkian, who, by the way, is also still alive. He sent a message to Pezeshkian by telegram. Obviously, there's concerns about speaking on the phone, because that might reveal Pezeshkian's whereabouts. But anyway, Putin's message read as follows: please accept my deepest condolences on the assassination of the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and his family members, committed in cynical violation of all norms of human morality and international law. Cynical violation of all norms of human morality and international law. And that comes from Putin himself. And there's the usual words of praise of Khamenei, but I will skip all of those. But those are Putin's words directly addressed to Pezeshkian, and they're very strong. At the UN Security Council, which note that the Americans and the Israelis did not bother to consult before they conducted the attack that they began yesterday. Well, we've all become used to that. They didn't bother. Trump didn't even bother, so far as I can see, to obtain any authorization from Congress either, which I know some people think might make his actions in conducting this attack impeachable. Well, that's for another time to discuss. Anyway, there was a furious row at the Security Council between the Russians, the Americans, the Israelis, and others. But perhaps the strongest comment of all has been made by the Russians in a statement published by their foreign ministry, which reads: on the morning of February 28th, US and Israeli armed forces carried out airstrikes on the territory of Iran. The scope and character of the military, political and propaganda preparations that preceded this reckless step, including the deployment of substantial US military forces to the region, leave no doubt that this is a deliberate, premeditated and unprovoked act of armed aggression against a sovereign and independent US member state in direct violation of the fundamental principles and norms of international law. It is particularly reprehensible that these strikes are once again being conducted under the cover of the renewed negotiation process, ostensibly intended to secure long-term normalization of the situation around the Islamic Republic of Iran. And then there comes, for what is for the Russians, I suspect, a particularly important issue. This comes despite assurances conveyed to Russia indicating that Israel had no interest in entering into military confrontation with Iran. What that refers to is an agreement that the Russians brokered between the Iranians and the Israelis at the end of last year, whereby each side, the Israelis and the Iranians, promised that there would be no attack by one upon the other unless the other attacked first. And then the statement continues that Washington and Tel Aviv have once again embarked on a perilous course that is swiftly pushing the region towards humanitarian, economic, and potentially even radiological disaster. That is perhaps a hint that eventually this might escalate into a nuclear confrontation. The aggressors, notice that Israel and Iran are now straightforwardly referred to as the aggressors. The aggressors' intentions are evident and have been stated openly to dismantle the constitutional order and remove the leadership of a state they deem undesirable because it has refused to yield to the dictates of force and hegemonic pressure. Responsibility for the impact of this man-made crisis, including the artificial the unpredictable chain reaction and the spiral of escalating violence rests entirely with them. The grave repercussions of these ill-conceived actions for the global non-proliferation regime, whose cornerstone is the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, are being openly disregarded. And the statement goes on in the same, using the same sort of terms, but it's a very, very long statement, and I'm not going to say more about it in this program. The Russians are furious. They see this as a massive breach of faith by Israel. They're obviously less than happy, in fact, furious with Trump himself. That, I suspect, is going to impact on the negotiations over the ending of the Ukraine war, as I discussed in my program yesterday. Medvedev said pretty much as much in his post on X yesterday. And notice here the identity of language used in the foreign ministry statement and in Putin's message to Pezeshkian. Putin speaks about a cynical act that violates all moral and international laws. And, well, the Russian Foreign Ministry is saying the same. And inevitably, in Moscow, more and more people are going to come forward and are going to say, well, given how Trump has acted, how can we continue to even think of trusting him on any issue, least of all the conflict in Ukraine? Now, to that, I'm now going to turn, though obviously what I'm going to say is going to be less than I usually say. Let's start, first of all, with Kirill Budanov, the man who is now Zelensky's chief of staff and who was one of the negotiators at the meetings in Abu Dhabi and in Geneva. Budanov gave an interview in which he said that the Russians have agreed to the United States giving security guarantees to Ukraine, that the only issue is territory, and that this agreement by the Russians was communicated to the Ukrainians over the course of the military-to-military discussions between Budanov himself and Admiral Kostyakov. Now, I interpret that as part of the dissension, the disputes that are taking place in Kiev at the present time, because I do not think that what Budanov is saying reflects the Russian position at all. On the contrary, the Russians have been saying in statement after statement, extending all the way back to Anchorage, but also over the last few days, that they have no objections to Ukraine being receiving security guarantees, but certainly they don't agree to the kind of security guarantees that are being talked about in the West, Article 5 type security guarantees, and that those security guarantees, the ones the West are going to provide to Ukraine, not only need to be coordinated with the Russians, who should also be one of the guarantor states, but that Russia also and simultaneously must receive its own security guarantees from the West. In other words, there needs to be a recalibration of the entire security architecture in Europe. That continues to be the publicly stated Russian position. I certainly don't think an intelligence officer like Kostyakov, who is not even a member of Russia's Security Council, has the authority to negotiate an issue of that importance. And, well, what Budanov is now saying is anyway contradicted by the reports that came from Kiev itself, that at the last meeting which took place in Geneva, the Russians took an exceptionally tough line, something which the Ukrainians said was the fault of the chief Russian negotiator, Vladimir Medinsky, who of course had been appointed to his position by none other than Putin himself. So Budanov, it's clear, is keen to try to get some end to the fighting. He knows how bad on the battlefield the situation for Ukraine is becoming. And he's trying to get more flexibility in the negotiations from his own side. He's prepared, for example, apparently, to consider some territorial concessions, something which Zelensky categorically rules out. And I think this interview that he has given should be understood in that context. It was The Economist who revealed that there was this division between Budanov and Zelensky on these issues. Now, for the rest, the Russians continue to press forward with a special military operation. The last 24 hours seem to have witnessed a certain reduction in drone and missile strikes, both by the Russians and the Ukrainians upon each other. But I get the sense that the Russian strikes previously had done an awful lot of damage, whilst the Ukrainians, maybe they're running out of drones, maybe they feel the drone attacks on Russia at a time when all the attention, global attention, is on the situation with Iran, don't matter as much. Who knows? Because for the Ukrainians, drone attacks on Russia are first and foremost a PR issue, just to say. Maybe that's the explanation for all of this. But anyway, on the front lines in Ukraine, things continue to move. And perhaps the most dramatic news, actually, is in fact taking place in Sumy region, far in the north, where the Russians now appear to be expanding the territory that they control around the city of Sumy very, very fast. And in a way that must be making some people in Kiev nervous that the Russians have some plans to storm the city of Sumy itself. There's a lot of speculation about what the Russians are doing in Kharkiv and in Sumy region along the border. The Russians, of course, still explain all of this as creation of a buffer zone. But in Sumy region especially, it seems to me to go well beyond that. It seems to me that this isn't actually a buffer zone exactly. It's a footing. The Russians are carving out a large footing, a base area, if you like, for a future offensive in northern Ukraine, which can only be ultimately directed at the city of Kiev itself. That's the first thing I'm going to say. But elsewhere, there is also a great deal of activity now. The Russians in particular seem to be focusing very heavily on the northern areas of the Donbas front lines. There's reports that they've captured more positions around Liman itself. I've heard reports that the Russians have more than enough forces to occupy the whole of Liman and could have done this weeks ago, but that they chose not to do so because they preferred to keep the Ukrainian garrison in Liman pinned down there, defending the town. It's not so much a plan to create a cauldron around this particular garrison, but rather to take more positions to the north and west of it, which is what the Russians appear to be doing, so that when the Ukrainians do eventually withdraw from Liman, which they inevitably will, the Russian positions will be even stronger in the north than they are. The fall of Liman and the fall of Rai Alexandrovka further south, which the Russians are now approaching, combined, by the way, with the fall of Kupiansk in the north, is going to be decisive. It is going to close the trap around the Ukrainian troops in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And as a Russian journalist writing for Radovka, pointed out, is also going to create a fragmentation in this area. It will make movement of troops and supplies between Slavyansk and Kramatorsk impossible, creating two cauldrons within the bigger cauldron around the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation that the Russians are busy creating. Anyway, elsewhere, I noticed that the Ukrainians have now coloured the whole of Grushino, the village to the northwest of Pokrovsk, as being in the grey zone, which to my mind confirms the report from Radovka that Grushino has essentially fallen to the Russians. I expect confirmation of that to be provided by the Russian Foreign Ministry, Defense Ministry, fairly soon. And, well, it seems that the situation in Konstantinovka continues to involve intense fighting. My sense is that the Ukrainian forces in southwestern Konstantinovka are by now mostly surrounded, and what we're now probably looking at there are mopping up operations. The key in the battle in Donbas is this development by the Russians of a cauldron around the Ukrainian forces, the remaining Ukrainian forces in Donbas. This is clearly what the Russians are working towards. And, well, if it's ever established, which it will be if Zelensky has his way and insists that the Ukrainians cannot withdraw from there, maybe the reason why Budanov wants to withdraw from Donbas is because he, unlike Zelensky, generally worries about the emergence of a cauldron there. Anyway, if there is a big cauldron in Donbas of the kind that the Russians seem to be working towards, then, as I said, it will be the biggest and most decisive battle of the war up till now. Now, there's been less news from Zaporozhye region over the last 24 hours. In fact, there's been practically no news at all. Bear in mind that the last we've been hearing is that the Russians were advancing and that the Ukrainian counteroffensive in the northeast of Zaporozhye was in standstill. If there's been no news, that is further indications that this Ukrainian offensive in northeast Donbas, in northeast Zaporozhye, is indeed in standstill. I expect that over the next few weeks, the Russian advance towards first Orekhov and then Zaporozhye City will resume in earnest, and then we will see. But anyway, this is where I'm going to finish the programme today. We are in a slogging match between the Iranians and the Americans and the Israelis. Obviously, the United States and Israel are far more powerful countries than Iran. But Iran has resources if it endures. If it sees this through, then, well, it won't win exactly in the sense of winning a military victory, but it will have exhausted the other side, and that will put it in a stronger position than the one it was in before. The IRGC is known to have felt that the 12-day war in June was ended by the Iranians prematurely, that the supreme leader, Khamenei in other words, and Pezeshkian agreed to a ceasefire at precisely the moment when the pendulum was starting to swing in Iran's favour. This time, one senses that there is no mood in Iran to make that mistake again. And of course, Khamenei himself is no longer there. The person who, for the moment at least, is making the decisions is Larijani, and he comes across as a much more tough-minded man altogether. But this conflict between Iran, Israel, and the United States continues to remain at issue. Ultimately, it depends on the internal stability and endurance of Iran. Despite the loss of Khamenei and many of their top leaders, they came through the first day and the first night. They continue to hit back. The only question is whether they will be able to keep on doing so. So this is where I finish my program today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and also, of course, our Substack site, where, by the way, I have written a long piece comparing the conflict in Iran with the conflict in Libya. I unearthed a piece I wrote about the Libyan war in 2011, and I pointed out that there are some striking resemblances, at least in the way in which the Americans have approached and sought to justify both wars. Anyway, and also please remember that you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.